This is Bob Fetrakis with The Other Side of the News, brought to you by thefreepress.org. WCRS Community Radio 98.3 and 102.1.
Hi, this is Bob Fetrakis from WGRN, the Green Renaissance Station 94.1. Privileged to have Ajamu Baraka, the Green Party candidate for Vice President of the United States in the 2016 election, and one of America's leading human rights activists. Welcome to The Other Side of the News, Ajamu.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right. A lot of things happening in the world as we speak related to human rights. We're broadcasting from the largest city in the Americas, named after Christopher Columbus. And we've had tremendous problems, particularly lately, with police brutality. Tim Davis was beat nearly to death and put on dialysis by the Columbus police. And many people that went out and protested made the connection between the large Columbus statue and more than 500 years of colonial and racist oppression, and how the police continue that legacy. Is that a valid analysis?
Well, I think it is, Bob, and I think that those kind of connections are being made by activists across the country. That what they are concluding is that while we cannot attempt to explain the persistence of state violence directed at black and brown people without grounding that analysis in an understanding of the historic nature of the relationship between black and brown people and the state and the genesis of this country. So the fact that this country was based on an experience of colonial oppression and enslavement, the death of Indian land, the fact that it was in fact a settler colony, and we know that at the center of most of those settler colonial experiences is violence. That's been the instrument that has characterized the relationship between black people specifically in the state and its representatives from the very beginning. So, you know, the connections that people are making, that we have to look at that historic relationship, and we have to look at the role of the police forces, or what some of us call the domestic military, its role and its relationship regarding black people, in order for us to make sense of the behavior of the police, not only there in Columbus, but really across the country. So, yes, those connections are important for us to understand that this is not just a situation of so-called bad apples, but it's reflective of a long-standing historic relationship that is structural in nature.
All right, we're speaking with Ajamu Baraka, who will be in Columbus Saturday, October 14th. At 2:30 p.m., sponsored by the Black Caucus of the Ohio Green Party. He'll be at A-Plus Arts Academy, 270 South Napoleon. And as an international human rights activist, he's been involved in a variety of things throughout the world and has picked up numerous perspectives regarding U.S. foreign policy. I noticed that you were on record, which often is challenged in the mainstream media, the situation in the Ukraine and Russia. That was a U.S.-backed coup, was it not? And in my mind, are we not surrounding Russia with U.S. military might? We've moved heavily into the Baltic states, you know, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. We've just cut a deal with Finland, which used to be neutral. And none of this seems to be talked about, that it looks like NATO and the United States are the aggressor and committed violations of international law by overthrowing a legitimate government. Why isn't that talked about very directly?
Well, you know, that is a good question. We have a very dangerous situation in that part of the world where the U.S. has been involved in changing that government in the Ukraine. They have been engaged in very provocative kinds of behaviors related to the Russians by increasing the rotation of NATO troops on Russia's western frontier. We know for a fact that the U.S. was involved and helped to, in fact, engineer the overthrow of a democratically elected government in the Ukraine. And as a consequence, you had the Crimea that went back into the Russian Federation, and you had the beginnings of ongoing conflict in eastern Ukraine. So the situation in that part of the country, part of the world, that is very dangerous, and it has not been talked about enough, especially when we started to wonder why there was an upsurge, an uptick, if you will, in neo-Nazi activity in the U.S. I made the connection that the uptick of neo-Nazism in the U.S. Has a connection to the support that the U.S. authorities gave to the right wing there in Ukraine, mm-hmm. which helped to embolden not only the right wing in Ukraine, but helped to embolden the right throughout Europe. So these issues need to be talked about. We have to make these connections in order to even understand, you know, the nature of political development in the U.S.
So does U.S. foreign policy then in some ways bear the responsibility of, say, the rise of right-wing neo-Nazi politics in Germany or in other parts of Europe?
Well, I think the U.S. Oligarchy, along with the oligarchical elements throughout Western Europe, their pursuit of neoliberal policies and anti-democratic practices have created the conditions in Western Europe and in the U.S. that help to embolden and to provide fuel, if you will, for that wing in both Europe and in the U.S. So while there's not, you wouldn't say that the U.S. was directly involved in the rise of neo-Nazism and the right in Western Europe, we can say that the policies pursued over the last few decades helps to explain the political and economic social conditions in both Western Europe and in the U.S. that can help explain the rise of these white nationalist neo-Nazi forces.
Again, I'm talking with Ajamu Baraka, who's coming on October 14th to Columbus from 2:30 to 4. He'll be speaking on, quote, resistance and black liberation in the age of Trump at A Plus Art Academy 270 South Napoleon. And at 6:30, He'll be at the Free Press Second Saturday Salon, 1021 East Broad Street, for a reception and a discussion. So the neoliberal trade policies, which you referenced, when we look at these policies, is it a continuation in some ways of colonialism? But it clearly has an effect on the U.S. population, right? We rushed into NAFTA without a democratic parliament, right? In Europe, they developed a European Union and a parliament. Here, it was just seemed like an agreement between the rich, between the oligarchs. And I did have the privilege of being Governor Brown's spokesperson as we went down to glorious defeat in 1992 and were told that Bill Clinton wanted to keep it out of the platform. He was really for a more just and democratic trade. He just didn't want to put it in the platform. All of that turned out to be a lie, as you well know. So how do we deal with situations like this where the two major parties both seem to be dedicated to the massive capitalistic exploitation of people around the world and turning our own people into right-wing populists and unleashing themselves in the support of Trump?
The neoliberal trade policies were part of the systematic assault on workers in both Western Europe and in the U.S. Of course, under the Clinton administration, that was the agenda that he came into office with. It was part of the reason why they militarized the border between the U.S. and Mexico. It was a continuation of the turn toward neoliberalism that we saw occur in the late 1970s. So that assault, that systematic assault on the working class, and in fact parts of the middle class, continued up through the Clinton administration into the Bush and the Obama administration. That has been the agenda of the transnational ruling class. To strengthen its grip on the international economy, to reduce the bargaining power of labor. In the U.S., it was to undermine the power of the working class and the organized sector of the working class, that is unions, in order to transform the U.S. economy into basically a low-wage economy, with the consequence being now that you have whole sectors of the population that are now economically redundant. So this is these are the conditions that have evolved as part of the neoliberal agenda, and they are the conditions that help to explain the intensifying tensions and contradictions in the politics and the economic activity we see here in the U.S. and indeed in Western Europe. So, you know, one has to understand the evolution of political economy, understand the nature of neoliberalism in order to understand why we have some of the social contradictions we have today.
You're listening to WGRN-FM, the Green Renaissance Station, 94.1. I'm talking with Ajamu Baraka, vice presidential candidate of the Green Party in the 2016 election. He'll be in Columbus from 2:30 to 4 p.m. speaking on resistance and black liberation in the age of Trump at the A-plus Art Academy, 270 South Napoleon. It's free. And also at 6:30, he'll be at the Free Press Second Saturday Salon, 1021 East Broad Street. So, getting back to the key point here, if all of this has been going on for decades and we've gone from 100,000 people or so in prison, you know, at the end of the 60s, around 1970s, to what appears to be a fake war on drugs that was targeted towards the white anti-war movement and the civil rights and black power movement, and you had this tremendous growth during the Nixon administration, and then it goes even further in the Reagan years with this massive prison industrial complex, and it's added to, federalized, so to speak, by Bill Clinton, and nothing really seems to be done of any significance to dismantle the largest prison system in the world. What can we do? And was that a deliberately constructed complex? Did they know what they were doing, or was it just done for politics?
Well, it was political, and it was the consequence of the restructuring of the economy, a restructuring that that resulted in large sectors of the population, in particular African Americans, becoming economically redundant. It created a situation, Bob, where because of the downward pressure on wages. Because of the inability of the economy to incorporate everyone who wanted to work. And that's why we have such a low rate of participation in the economy today. You know, people talk about the low unemployment rate, but that's a phony figure because they're not counting the fact that there are millions of people who are not participating in the economy. That, you know, part of what has happened as a consequence of neoliberal restructuring is that you have a young black man, for example, who's 18, who may be able to secure a minimum wage job, which will pay him around $15,000 a year, which means he has about $15,000 in the ability to consume goods and services. But you take that same black man, that same black body, incarcerate that black person, and he or now she is able to generate $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, in some places more, in terms of goods and services. Mm-hmm. They provide employment. You know, so you have a situation now where it is more valuable to have people locked up than participating in the so-called free economy. This is the consequence of neoliberal capitalism. So was it intentional? Well, we know that in the 1980s, there was a move toward lock them up and throw away the key. That continued and intensified really under the Democrat Party administration of Bill Clinton. And it became a way in which you had, in essence, a job program for rural white communities, and so it became it was a convergence of interests between the ruling class and large numbers of workers in these rural parts of the country, all benefiting from the super exploitation of black and brown bodies. So, if it wasn't intentional, the consequence of it is just as devastating.
But politically, if, you know, Halderman's famous quote that surfaced last year from a 1994 interview, you know, here's the key aide to Richard Nixon, who said we knew the war on drugs was, you know, completely bogus, but we were doing it to suppress our political enemies. So in some way, the war on drugs is sort of like COINTELPRO. I mean, you use it as a political tool. Is that not the case?
That part of it was in fact true. That the war on drug had it was a win-win situation for the Nixon administration, in that it played to their political base. It allowed for more space for the political police, primarily in the form of the FBI, to attack and suppress the growing radical movement in the U.S. With a special emphasis on the Black Liberation Movement. It resulted in the beginnings of the escalation of incarceration. So it was a situation that was intentional in that sense. And it was is a convenient weapon that's being used even today, of course. For example, you know, the Trump administration is actively undermining the peace process in Colombia. And what they're using is their so-called concern about drugs, and saying that the current President Santos has not been as aggressive as he should have been in trying to stamp out the cocaine industry, a industry that they claim benefits the guerrillas. So they're using the same war on drugs weapon, not just in the U.S., but as a political weapon, even in an environment like Colombia. So, yes, there's components of that that's clearly intentional. We know that the counterinsurgency that was organized in the 1970s had the intent to undermine the Black Liberation Movement and to undermine the radical movement. And one component of that was, in fact, the drug war. We know that if you back up into the 1960s, that basically the drugs were used as an instrument to undermine the cohesion, the social cohesion within the Black communities. We know that the crack epidemic in the 1980s, again, a win-win for the authorities, because you had a situation where they were attempting to raise resources to illegally fund their operations in places like Nicaragua, while at the same time causing social havoc in the Black communities. So the drugs has always been an important weapon by the intelligence agencies and the ruling elements in the U.S.
Well, I was thinking about that as you were speaking, right? The famed deal with Lucky Luciano, where he was released with the mafia and an agreement that, you know, they could sell drugs in the inner cities. The French Connection, right? The Corsican Brotherhood, which, you know, the CIA cut a deal with in exchange for breaking the strikes in France after World War II. You know, the CIA would look the other way when they ran drugs into New York City. Air America, right? While Nixon's conducting this war, the Hmong and Mayo tribesmen at Long Chen have one of the largest and busiest airports on Earth with Air America, right? We make movies about this, but this is all factual. You know, the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia by Professor McCoy. I mean, all this stuff is well documented that in Iran-Contra. I mean, you've got the 900-page Senate report from John Kerry and Hank Snow, which many think is a whitewash, but the stuff that was revealed on the drug dealing, you know, is mind-boggling. That at the same time you'd have a war on drugs when the people transshipping it really are your national security agencies.
Mm-hmm. And what was interesting about that report was the role of the banks in terms of how money was, how dependent many of those international banks ended up being on the flow of money as a consequence of the drug industry. So
and the overinflation of the stock market as well.
Yes. So the question becomes, how do we counter that, and what is the significance of that politically at the current moment? I would say that basically, you know, what we see is within the domestic politics, we are seeing that there's a change in the public attitude toward drugs somewhat now that you have this epidemic in the white communities.
Mm-hmm.
and that the drug war is not as important for them now, now that they have the so-called war on terror. That becomes the entry point for undermining and terrorizing communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm wondering because, I mean, we're in Ohio, which has the largest per capita, you know, OD rate. And we're talking about small town, rural Ohio. You know, my community college just last week, we had somebody ODing in the bathroom, a student there. I mean, this is really permeated the white suburbs, particularly the working class suburbs. So it would be impossible to maintain a drug war if it really was a drug war evenly distributed against all races and classes.
Yes, isn't it interesting that as the intensification of the contradictions of neoliberal capitalism increases, where you have the material conditions for us to be able theoretically to organize a more effective opposition, you know, and now you have this new drug epidemic, and now is targeting those sectors of the population who have been experiencing some quite horrific consequences of neoliberalism. Throughout the so-called Rust Belt, you know, those elements that are now seen after a few decades that their plight is no more different than the plight of those working class black folks who, it's from time to time, they will look down their nose at. So you have the basis for the potential unity of the classes, but now you have this drug epidemic. I mean, so you have this double punch, the drugs. And the issue of race that's undermining the ability of us to build a more effective opposition here in this country. It is quite remarkable.
Well, I recall the UN Truth Commission and reports on South Africa where, you know, you had to tell the truth to be absolved. And the key thing there was, I remember someone came out and said the CIA had provided ecstasy and other drugs in hopes of stopping a movement that was unstoppable. So, you know, it's not beyond a reason that, you know, we know the government in the past has used drugs in a variety of ways. We're down to the last minute here, Jamu. What else would you like to tell the listeners about your trip to Columbus? Resistance and black liberation in the age of Trump.
Well, I would say that we want to encourage people to come out so we can have a conversation. I mean, as everyone can see from this conversation, that all of these issues are linked, and that we're not going to be able to build a more effective opposition until we understand how these issues are in fact linked to a broader whole. And so we're going to talk about all these issues and connect all of them. When we talk about black liberation in the age of Trump, we're not just talking about the liberation of black folks. We're saying that the black liberation movement is important. It's a centerpiece of resistance. But that struggle is to liberate all of us who are oppressed by this backward system. So we'll come out. I encourage everybody to come out. Let's have conversations. Let's get some theoretical clarity so that we can go forward and build the movement that the historic moment demands.
Thank you, Jamu Baraka, Green Party vice presidential candidate and international human rights activist. 2:30 to 4 p.m. Saturday, October 14th, Resistance and Black Liberation in the Age of Trump, A-plus Art Academy, 270 South Napoleon. It's free. Also free press, Second Saturday Salon, 6:30, 1021 East Broad Street. Come out and listen to Jamu Baraka reflect on this time period. Thank you.
Thank you.